Anyway, thank you, Dr. Fitton. Thank you, Dr. Merman. Actually, Jono and I do have a very nice picture of us about 20 years ago at a kite festival in Berkeley that I was going to share, but one of my daughters was missing, and your children were missing. So we actually go way back, and I do feel like we're BFFs. So today I want to start with sort of going over, there's been a lot of really exciting information at this conference, and sort of obviously we've been talking about the fact that we're in a changing environment, we're sort of in a changing way of thinking about doing STD prevention. We heard that we should not be transformed, we want to transform before we are transformed by others. So just I'm going to quickly review where we are with STD prevention, review some of the changing landscape issues that you've heard and Dr. Merman's also discussed. And why we at the Division of STD at CDC feel like we need to repurpose our prevention priorities and our approaches for the next few years, kind of how I'm seeing the role of future STD programs, and as well as mentioning some of these new programmatic initiatives I think we need to start thinking about and getting involved in. And again, we've got a lot of similarities where I think DHAP is looking at similar issues. So where are we with STD prevention? People have heard this before, you know, we really look back to the shadow on the land, 1937, where we've been really using a very sort of straightforward approach that really hasn't changed for decades, with focusing on health education and promotion, some behavior change, spending most of our resources in identifying and treating infected individuals through either screening or appropriate diagnosis. STD clinics were originally designed to take care of symptomatic individuals. Vaccinations obviously came a little bit later from 1937, but we can't forget those important interventions that we have. But most of our interventions have been individually based, and they've predominantly been focused in STD clinics with the support of disease investigation staff, and they've really been funded only with public dollars. I do want to highlight, though, some good news that I think we need to be mindful of. We are actually still at an all-time low with the number of case reports of primary and secondary syphilis. Still, it's a burden that's very high, certainly has important outcomes that we need to improve on. But at least we're working at a level that was significantly less than we saw in the early 90s. We have a similar story for our rates of gonorrhea, starting in 1941, following our rates of disease. Out to 2010, again, an all-time low, and we're hoping to keep it low or even make it lower with our concern about emerging cephalosporin-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea. Our chlamydia trends are hard to interpret. It's sort of interesting that while we've been doing a lot of opportunistic gonorrhea screening with our chlamydia screening programs, and we did not see rising gonorrhea, we have been seeing continuing increases in our number of chlamydia cases, mainly because we feel like we're doing more screening, we're using better tests, and we're hoping that more people are reporting their cases to state and local health departments that eventually come to us at CDC. It's been discussed a lot at this conference about the sort of changing, you know, health systems. When we talk about health systems, we're talking about healthcare, and we're talking about public health. And I think that we've got to be very go home from today and really look at where is your state and local health department in terms of the changing healthcare systems in your area, because a lot of these changes are happening at different levels, at different places, at different times. And I think a lot of our solutions are going to have to be very individualized to what's happening at the local level. We've heard a lot at the conference about there's the potential of our vulnerable populations, our at-risk populations, potentially could be shifting to federally qualified health centers, school-based health centers. These are facilities that are being invested in through our healthcare delivery system. We've got people that are having more insurance coverage. So we really do have an opportunity to actually expand the reach of the populations that we wish to serve. We've also noticed that the healthcare system has an interest in quality of care as opposed to only cost, or fraud, which it looked at in the past. So I think we should take advantage of the interest in quality of care and use our expertise to help places that are serving vulnerable populations to make sure they're providing the quality of care that we expect these clients to receive. There's also been a lot of discussion about the new investment in health information technology, again, mainly in the healthcare delivery system, not as much in the public health system. But these data systems are going to allow us to have large data sets that we can use for surveillance, we can use for assessment, we can use for quality improvement programs that would be readily available to us. We would not have to collect data. We just have to have a way to access the data and to be able to analyze the data. So I think this is another area of huge opportunity for programs at the state and local level. Clearly, we know we're majorly under-resourced. Even though we're at all-time lows of disease, we still have high burdens of infections, sexually transmitted infections in the United States. And we've got to come up with some creative ways to maximize our efficiencies and figure out what our most cost-effective and effective and feasible interventions are. I don't think that we have enough science that really dictates what our most high-impact interventions are, and we need to figure that out. Most of you who are working in resource-constrained environments are getting budget cuts and drills all the time about, you know, what is this, what's my return on my investment here with my public dollars. So we've got to start building a better business case for the work that we do, despite the fact that at this time we really are losing a lot of public health dollars, a lot of public health infrastructure, and even within the public health system, there's a lot of competing priorities. I've seen a shift sort of from the infectious disease focus of public health departments over the years to more of a chronic disease focus, and I think we who work in the field of infectious diseases have to figure out how do we fit in to these new paradigms that are being developed at the state and local level. So there's a lot of questions that I sort of ask every day when I get up in the morning, and I'm hoping you're going to help me answer these as we move forward in the next couple of years. So how should STD prevention take advantage of the changes that are occurring? I think we should really look at opportunities and move forward and take advantage where we can. What is our role in identifying and addressing prevention gaps as a result of the changes? And what should our programs look like, at least in the next couple of years and beyond? So I want to talk a little bit about why we at CDC have decided to, you know, pick a few priorities to work on over the next few years and the approaches that we're looking at within these priorities. First of all, as has been mentioned in this conference, there's a number of new national strategies, the National Prevention Strategy, the National HIV Strategy, and the IOM Report on Women's Preventive Services. All of these strategies speak to STD prevention. You should read these strategies and see where STD prevention fits into these work. They talk a lot about health equity issues. They talk a lot about quality of care and standard of care. So we are using these national strategies to inform how we think about STD prevention at CDC. We've actually developed a vision for STD prevention for the next few years. It's actually, ironically, fairly similar to the National AIDS Strategy vision that was not out before we came up with this vision. But we're hoping to have a future in which all Americans, regardless of gender, age, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, are knowledgeable and empowered and have ready access to a network of culturally competent, high-quality, evidence-based, and confidential STD prevention services and highly trained professionals to prevent, treat, and manage sexually transmitted infections. Some of you have seen sort of this strategic map that we've developed for the next few years. Maybe others haven't. I want to make sure that everyone hears where we're going from the federal standpoint. We certainly want to build our science and our evidence base so that we do have the best information to inform not only the quality that we need in our public health workforce, but to have the interventions that we can use to address these urgent threats and important priorities. So we're really going to be focusing on two disease-specific areas, resistant gonorrhea and congenital syphilis elimination, which is a global winnable battle for Dr. Friedman at CDC. And then we want to change our approach a little bit and become a little bit more holistic and look at what we can do more on a population-based level. And given that the burden of our infections predominantly are in adolescents and young adults, as well as men who have sex with men, these are the two populations that we really, really want to focus on. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about what's happening in these four areas so that you can think about things that you can take home with you and maybe make some changes in your practice. For those of you who've been outside looking at the Onion, I guess it's widely distributed in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. If you hadn't read the article about the new antibiotic-resistant gonorrhea strain, we had a number of quotes, one from a scientist saying, if only those blank bioethicists would quit meddling with my gonorrhea-resistant human research, certainly pertains to our recent important discussion around Guatemala. Then we have, hey, ladies, no worries here. My gonorrhea is still 100% treatable by cephalosporins. So what do you say, mamacita? And then we have, suddenly, I don't really want to get gonorrhea anymore. So for those of you who have not been following the gonorrhea story, we would like you to get you up to speed. We're very concerned. This organism is a very complicated bacteria. It's very smart. It's smarter than a human. And for years, it has always been able to find a way to mutate and become resistant to the drugs that we are using to treat the infection. The trends that we have seen with our penicillin resistance, our fluoroquinolone resistance, is for whatever reason, we start seeing decreased susceptibility and eventually resistance that seems to come from the West. So first we start seeing problems on the West Coast, and it usually occurs more commonly among men who have sex with men before it spreads to the heterosexual population. So we are starting to see the same trend. Now, we're not at a resistant level yet. We're only talking about decreased susceptibility, but these are data looking at the proportion of GC isolates with elevated MICs to cefixime, that's the oral treatment for gonorrhea, of greater than or equal to 0.25 micrograms per liter, that's the threshold of a susceptible isolate, by region and by sex partners. And while I've recently learned at CDC we're not supposed to be doing 3D graphs, sometimes it's easier to see the visual when you can look at things three-dimensionally. So we are already above 5% of strains from our gonococcal isolate surveillance project that are collected in the western part of the United States among men who have sex with men is already above 5%. So we are challenged. We're also challenged to respond because, in general, there's sort of among the general clinical community, there's a low level of awareness of the problem. We're also challenged because we're at the last drug we have available that's known to be effective to treat gonorrhea, so we're sort of at the end of the drug pipeline. In the past, when we've had problems, we've just switched to the next effective drug. We're challenged by the lack that we have a GIST surveillance system for antimicrobial resistance, which is very effective at identifying problems, but it's not timely. Sometimes it can take as long as 3 months before the clinic finds out that the isolate they submitted for susceptibility testing actually returns with the result and says, you might want to go find that partner. That's a concerning MIC level that is returned. We're doing this at the time that we're seeing declining STD control resources. And in general, when we tried to control resistant gonorrhea in the past, we've been very unsuccessful with the tools that we have available, be it contact tracing or broadening screening programs or doing more network analysis. So we really are at a stage where we want to mitigate the emergence of cephalosporin resistance. We don't know when it's going to happen. That's the challenge. But what we want people to focus on now is we really want to refocus on sort of our gonorrhea control efforts and make sure that we're doing the best we can in terms of appropriate screening, using the recommended regimens for cases that you're treating, making sure that partners are treated, and kind of remind clinicians that we have concerns. I think a lot of times when a patient comes back with another gonorrhea infection, it's just assumed that this is a reinfection from an untreated partner. I think we want clinicians to lower their level of suspicion, be vigilant for any type of treatment failures, and when in doubt, get people back in and check them, and when in doubt, we'd like them to get a culture, which is also not widely available anymore. So state and local health departments are going to have to find ways to build their culture capacity again. Clinicians are going to have to find ways that they can find culture in their geographic area. We certainly are working at CDC with NIH on looking for new treatment opportunities, and we're also working with WHO on the sort of global issue because this is not unique to the United States. There's already been case report of treatment failures in both the West and in Europe. We also want to, the other reason why we took the priority of focusing on the burden of STDs and MSM and not just syphilis and MSM and syphilis elimination, that we think the problem is across the board with gonorrhea, syphilis, and the role it plays in, at least as a risk marker for HIV, and in some cases in facilitation of HIV transmission. I think most people are well aware that if you look at our case reports of primary and secondary syphilis reported in the United States by sex, sexual behavior, and race ethnicity, we've only recently been collecting gender of partners at the national level, so we don't have a lot of trend data, but we generally feel that we've been seeing a significant increase of syphilis over the last 5 or 10 years, depending on where you live, among men who have sex with men. And it seems to be most significant among young black men, especially in the South. We've seen about 150% increase in primary and secondary syphilis in young black men. It's also in the same geographic area where you're seeing large increases in your HIV incidence. I do like to remind people of a quote that Judy Auerbach made when she was describing addressing the social drivers of HIV/AIDS. I think it also applies to us and STDs. Much of what humans do, think, and desire is influenced, if not determined, by key elements of social life, including norms, values, networks, structures, and institutions. So I think when we're trying to figure out how are we going to, you know, reduce burden of STIs among MSM, we certainly heard in this conference that we've got to start addressing broader health concerns of these men while also focusing on sexual risks. We also have to tackle some of these environmental challenges that we have, and we really need to start looking at the use of a more positive frame sexual health approach. So I think we're going to have to go back and look at our programs, and I think we're going to need to be working with our HIV colleagues who are looking at the exact same issues of the exact same people, and we really need to start working together on this, on these issues together, not in our separate silos. In terms of STIs among adolescents and young adults, we have had something called the Infertility Project for a number of years that focused on chlamydia and gonorrhea screening, mainly in STD clinics and in family planning clinics. I know some people have heard that maybe IPP is going away. It is not going away. We want to expand what we're doing around infertility prevention, and we also want to acknowledge all the other important issues we should be doing with adolescents, especially around HPV. If you don't know, we are challenged by our case-based reporting, so we've been monitoring chlamydia prevalence in sexually active females aged 14 to 24 through the NHANES survey, and clearly we have a significant prevalence of in a population-based sample of chlamydia in young people that you can see 6.8% in the 14 to 19-year-old age group and 20 to 24%, 3.2% in the 20 to 24-year-old age group. So obviously an important problem that we've been trying to tackle with our broad-based screening programs. So we want to expand beyond our STD clinic screening, our family planning screening. We want to expand our screening programs into these federally qualified health centers and where any vulnerable women at risk for chlamydia are going to be seen. This is sharing some of the HEDIS data that we're monitoring closely in commercial plans, Medicaid plans. It's also comparing to what's been happening with breast cancer screening, cervical cancer screening. A lot of those screening rates are fairly plateaued. But it's interesting, we've been making some improvements slowly. In 2010, 41% of 16 to 20-year-olds were screened according to the HEDIS measure, and we were doing better in adolescents in the Medicaid program of 55%. We also tend to see the 21 to 26-year-olds, they access care a little bit more, again, are being screened. But if you look at these numbers, we're still missing about half of the young women that need to be screened. We're also monitoring the estimated vaccination coverage with HPV in this country. This was recently published in the MMWR, comparing various adolescent vaccines, Tdap, the conjugate meninge vaccine, and then those who HPV-1 means they got one dose of HPV vaccine versus the HPV-3 is those who completed the three-dose series. So just in summary, not even 50% of young women are being vaccinated for HPV. Again, a similar story to what we're seeing with our chlamydia screening programs, and that it's another opportunity for integrating our services and providing a more holistic approach to the work that we do. Lastly, congenital syphilis was picked as a priority. First of all, because we know we have some very effective tools for reducing the burden of syphilis in heterosexual populations. We want to continue using those tools successfully. And the way to reduce congenital syphilis is to reduce syphilis in women of reproductive age. For those of you who haven't thought much about congenital syphilis for a while, it's actually the oldest recognized congenital infection that was described in the 14th century. We know how to treat it. We know that universal screening treatment of pregnant women is the most cost-effective public health intervention that we have, but we also know that a case of congenital syphilis in our country is a sentinel event. It basically represents a failure of the healthcare delivery system and a failure of public health. So if you want to use this as a marker, an impact measure of where we're losing erosion of providing services, congenital syphilis is something we should be monitoring, because if we're going to start seeing problems with congenital syphilis, we're probably going to see a lot of problems in other areas, including HIV and other diseases within our center. It's amazing to me when you actually go back and look at the rates of congenital syphilis in the 40s and 50s in the United States. We were talking about, you know, rates of over 600 per 100,000 live births. So the good news is we've got a lot of states that don't have to use their STD dollars for congenital syphilis in terms of interventions. They just need to be monitoring, making sure they're not having any problems or any sentinel events. But we clearly still have some problems in our country where there's just too many cases of congenital syphilis, and we really need to better understand why. We certainly are going to be working with DHAP and linking to their maternal and child transmission for HIV programs, because we really should be doing better than this. Now, what's the role of future STD programs? I know that everyone is very interested in how we're thinking about this at CDC. I would like to just summarize from a lot of the work that's been discussed at this conference. I think in general we're going to be doing a little bit less or more, quite a bit less direct service delivery. I think we're going to be fostering more collaborations and partnerships between public health and our healthcare providers that are serving the at-risk populations that need the prevention services that we know are important. I think we have opportunities to strengthen our surveillance, assessment, assurance, and continuous quality improvement functions, especially through the health information technology that's going to be available to us. But certainly we also still need to be able to figure out how to monitor who is underserved, who is not being served, and what really the safety net needs are, because that's where we are going to have to play a role. We definitely need better metrics, how to evaluate the impact of our programs, and we obviously need to be probably investing more of our resources into the assessment, insurance, and policy development areas of public health, and a little bit less in the direct delivery service. Now, what's going to happen with STD clinics? There was a very lively debate yesterday about whether STD clinics just should go away or whether we should just have everyone going to STD clinics. I think that we're going to be somewhere in the middle on this issue. I don't think STD clinics should go away, but I think they've got to find their role in this new changing healthcare environment. I certainly believe the public dollars are getting shorter and shorter, and we've got to find ways to maintain our clinics, and billing is going to be one of those opportunities, finding ways to get into the accountable care organizations, becoming part of the essential community provider network, being affiliated with federally qualified health centers is something that we're going to be working on. I think the role of STD clinics are going to be needed for safety net services for the uninsured or for the insured that do not want to access their confidential STD care with their primary care provider. I also think STD clinics are going to absolutely have to have specialty services and be seen for their excellence and their low-cost services that they provide. They also need to be our centers of training and research. How are we ever going to do a gonorrhea treatment trial if we have to go to the federally qualified health centers and wait for a case to come in once a month? So it's critical that we keep these concentrated centers of excellence for those purposes. The role of DIS, I also think is going to be changing. I do believe that it's absolutely critical that we keep a workforce that knows how to do field investigation at the local level, because those are the ones that get called for all public health problems, H1N1 and beyond. But I do think we're going to have to expand the skill set of what our field investigative staff do. We need to come up with some more efficient and innovative partner services in a lot of areas with the geographic distribution of cases and contacts. It could take 2 days to drive to find a contact, to spend an hour to get them in for care. So we are going to have to look at more innovative ways through our social media, through phone work, et cetera, to do partner services. Also work with our clients to have them assist getting partners in as well. I think our DIS need to be trained in high-intensity behavioral counseling. We talked about this. They need cross-training. They need also to be majorly involved in linkage to care activities. You know, they need to develop new relationships with new partners, maybe become more patient navigators, is a new term that everyone's using, and maybe they need to become eligibility workers that know how to enroll people into Medicaid so that people actually do have insurance and get the services that they need. There's a number of new programmatic directions. We want to have time for discussion, so I just want to embrace Dr. Fenton and the center's cross-cutting frameworks. I will be expecting STD programs to be advancing prevention through healthcare, improving program collaboration and service integration, optimizing sexual health, and promoting health equity and reducing health disparities. Like Dr. Merman mentioned, I think that we've also got to start bringing our science and programs closer together. We need to better understand combination prevention strategies and program science and be thinking about how we can change the way that we do business. Certainly, population health and public health is a complex adaptive system, so programs really need to be identifying their context and their prevention targets. They need to recognize the importance of complexity science and intervention mix. They need to design system models for planning, coverage, and scale up. And we really need, in STD prevention, to be improving our impact monitoring and evaluation tools and metrics. There's a lot of good work going out in the field. We need to evaluate it so we know what is the best work that we need to continue doing. And the reason why we need to do this is I've never seen the landscape as it is today, but funders, all funders, government funders, private funders, are demanding evidence that investments improve health outcomes. So we're really going to have to figure out how to do this, and we're going to need to do it through impact evaluation. So I'd just like to summarize and sort of looking forward. I think we are challenged in STDs because we don't have one disease and one focused population. We've got diverse epidemics that require new targeted and diverse approaches. The vertical approach, I think, is unlikely to continue to be effective, so we're going to have to expand our partnerships. We're going to have to find new champions to work with. I certainly believe in STD prevention. Our key partners are our HIV prevention colleagues and our reproductive health colleagues. I think we've got different populations and different issues, and that's where I think we're going to need to be working much more closely together with our new approaches, with our evidence-based approaches. And I would just like to end with the quote that Dr. Kern stated at the beginning of the conference was, people make the difference. And I truly believe that. I think all of you are phenomenal. I know we're going to be able to move forward at this time of change and really advance the field of STD prevention, and I look forward to working with you.
Gail, Jono, thank you so much for two amazing presentations.